We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
South Korea is our ally. It has been since the Korean War, and we strongly affirm our commitment to defend South Korea as part of that alliance.
President Obama talking with ABC's Barbara Walters about the shelling of a South Korean island by the North and what role the United States may play there. James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic, and he joins us most Saturdays. Jim, it's good to talk with you.
Greetings, Audie. Nice to talk to you.
Let's talk more about the U.S. role here. The president made it sound pretty clear when talking about the U.S.-South Korea alliance, but there's also China as a big part of this as well.
One of the few things that is clear here is the U.S.-South Korean tie, because for reasons of history and treaty, the U.S. is certainly committed to South Korea's defense. Beyond that, almost everything that matters in this situation is very difficult to understand at the moment. The fundamental question, of course, is what is going on in North Korea and what next step the regime there might take. Beyond that is the very, very important question of what China will decide to do and will be able to do. China's is the one foreign government that's thought to have any insight at all into what's going on in North Korea or any influence over North Korea. And the rest of the world is expecting China, as part of its new great power status, to be able to play a placating role or a stabilizing role here. But it's not entirely clear the Chinese will be able to do that or will be able to have any influence if they did. And beyond that is the question of how the Chinese will respond if the U.S. continues, as it says it's going to reinsert its naval presence all around the Korean Peninsula. All the other countries in the area welcome this as a stabilizing force, but the Chinese have sent mixed signals about whether they welcome this or resent it.
And we're going to hear more about South Korea from one of our foreign reporters in a minute, but I wanted to turn to a different national security situation. News this week that here the Department of Homeland Security is going to be doing away with the color-coded threat chart.
I view this as welcome news in the whole question of how the United States can deal with the ongoing real threat of a terrorist attack without entirely distorting its national politics or its economy or its civil liberties toward that end. There was almost nobody left to speak in favor of the color-coded chart anymore. It hasn't changed in about 4 years. It's always been an orange. A spokesman for the Homeland Security Department said a couple of days ago that it outlived its usefulness, but nonetheless, it lived on. So the fact that something that even its originators thought no longer had any real utility was still there illustrated the phenomenon I think of as security theater ratchet effect, where these things which look as if they're protecting people in one way or another are easy to add but very difficult to take away. So if the color chart is finally being removed, that is one step against the ratchet, one step in the right direction.
And these aren't easy questions to answer. I mean, this news was pretty much overshadowed by the whole airport, TSA, pat-down debate that seemed to have taken over the news over the last week.
It sure was. And that, I think, is a debate we're going to have for years and years. The news just today of the would-be bomber who was arrested in the Northwest for a planned Christmas festival bombing may be an illustration once again that the main breakthroughs that have happened so far in thwarting terrorist attacks have been through intelligence operations and old-style police work type stings, as opposed to these screening measures that get so much of our attention and require so much cost and inconvenience.
James Fallows is national correspondent with The Atlantic, and he joins us here most Saturdays. You can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you, Audie.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. For many Americans, football is as much a part of Thanksgiving weekend as turkey and mashed potatoes. And on Thursday, fans were treated to more than 9 hours of it.
Antonio Cromartie with his third interception of the season.
And this is what's going to be called quarters coverage. You divide the field in quarters.
Team rivalries can sometimes split families apart, but everyone seems to agree on one thing. Those play-by-play guys can be annoying.
Is that quarter coverages?
That was quarters.
Yeah, well, 75 cents had a shot at it back then.
Tonight, the NFL Network is trying something different. It's rebroadcasting one of Thursday's games without the announcers. The commentary during the game will come largely from the people on the field. The players, coaches, and referees, all providing their own narratives.
Thursday night football, all eyes on us. Everybody's watching. The whole world is watching.
Here come the New York Jets, baby. Here we go.
Rob Gehring is the producer behind this massive project, and I caught him in between edits at the NFL Films Complex in New Jersey. More than anyone watching the game this past Thanksgiving, Gehring had the inside scoop.
We're talking about, you know, 13 players and coaches wired, and I actually had all 13 wires at my disposal. So I could listen to every wire as it was happening live. So I was making notes to myself kind of from a storytelling standpoint to start to figure out, okay, what are the great things that I'm hearing? What do I want to make sure is going to be in the show?
Keep the hammer on these guys. Keep pounding these backs. They get through the line. Great short tackling.
The game pitted the New York Jets against the Cincinnati Bengals. The two teams boast some of the biggest personalities in the NFL. Jets head coach Rex Ryan can be charitably described as uninhibited. And the Bengals have a wide receiver with his own reality TV show, Chad Ochocinco.
Ocho came by that sideline a lot, and he chirped a pretty good amount. And him and Rex had some really good, fun-loving exchanges. In fact, Ochocinco talked a lot throughout the whole game, and you really get an idea of the emotion involved. They have this passion for it, and you don't get that in a TV broadcast, I don't think.
So what does Rob Gehring hope to accomplish by taking away the play-by-play announcers?
I think what I want people to take from this is a little bit more of a connection to the players. And I think being able to hear what these guys go through during a game, I just think it's really invaluable for being able to really appreciate what NFL football is all about.
He's got a touchdown. He's got a touchdown. Go, 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 Brad.
Jets are soaring high, baby.
The NFL Network will air its announcerless game tonight at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Producer Rob Gehring is probably still hard at work on it.
We've had all hands on deck here since about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning on Friday morning right after the game. And we've pretty much just been working nonstop since. But we've made our way through it all, and we're hoping that it's something really special for the audience.
There's a picture from the Second World War that's probably been seared into the minds and souls of millions since it was seen. A young boy in short pants, a long coat, and a cap, with his arms raised in surrender, as men in German uniforms point powerful guns at him. Little boy has thin, fragile legs and a look of confusion and terror on his face. Dan Porat, who teaches at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, has written a book which tries to help us look deeply into that picture and history, looking for what happened to the boy, the man who pointed his gun, the woman in front at a column of prisoners who looks back in concern, the man who snapped the photograph, and the general who ordered the operation, as well as millions of people that we cannot see. His book is called The Boy, A Holocaust Story. Dan Porat joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And all these years later, what do we know for certain about that photo?
Not much. When we talk about the little boy, the one and only thing we can say definitively about him is that he's in all likelihood younger than 10 years old because he doesn't have a Star of David on his clothing. Mm-hmm. What we can say is more about the Germans that are in this picture, primarily about the soldier holding his gun behind the little boy who was arrested after World War II. His name is Josef Bloche.
We know that this is a photo of the liquidation of the Warsaw Ghetto.
Yes. It was basically incorporated within a report submitted by the notorious German general Jürgen Strupp to the leadership of the Nazis in Berlin, reporting about his achievement, so to say, of liquidating the entire Warsaw Ghetto. And within this report, he incorporated 52 photographs from the Warsaw Ghetto liquidation. One of these photos is this iconic photo of the little boy.
And I dare say some of the hardest sections to read in your book are the quotations verbatim from that report where General Strupp was clearly proud of what happened.
Yes, for Strupp, he was mostly concerned about fulfilling and achieving and promoting his own career. From his point of view, he had to finish this mission as fast as possible. He promised to do it within 3 days. It ended up taking him more than 4 weeks. And this report, in part, is attempting to rehabilitate his inability to fulfill this mission within 3 days. Stroop was also trying to convey his control of the forces, his control of the evacuation of the Jews in an orderly manner, and by that to rehabilitate his standing in Berlin.
Who took the photograph?
The photograph was in all likelihood taken by an administrative officer in the SS named Franz Conrad. He was, in fact, a member of the Social Democratic Party, and it was only later that when he was caught by the Austrian police after stealing 900 shilling from his employer, that he was taken into the Nazi party by his attorney, and the Nazi party supported him while he was in jail, and then he joined the Nazi ranks. During the revolt, he was commanded by Strupp to join him wherever he went in the ghetto, and he was carrying a camera on his shoulder and taking most of these photos that are incorporated in this victory album of the Nazis.
Who was the woman who looked back in concern?
Frankly, we do not know her name. We do not know any name of any of the Jews within this photo. In my book, I do portray the story of one woman,
yeah,
Rivka Trafkovich, who in all likelihood saw these Nazis taking photos. I cannot say whether she saw them taking this specific photo or any one of the other photos, but she reports coming out of the bunker and seeing a group of Nazis taking photos repeatedly.
What happened to Conrad, the photographer?
Conrad was caught by the Americans, the CIC, the predecessor of the CIA, in the summer of 1945, after the CIC got a tip that Conrad is holding on to the personal diaries of Hitler. The CIC ends up catching Conrad and finding instead a pair of shredded trousers of Hitler. When asked why was he possessing these, he responded that he was planning to sell them in America for a lot of money. He was then extradited to Poland, stood trial together with Strupp, was convicted of murdering 7 Jews and sending about 1,000 others to the death camps, and was executed together with Strupp in March of 1952.
And Joseph Bloch, the man pointing his gun at the little boy.
At the end of the war, Bloch was caught by the Soviets, but they did not associate him in any way or manner with the SS. And he would end up marrying and becoming a loving and caring father. His wife would testify later that he would care and worry about each and every ailment of their children. And for 19 years, they lived a happy marriage. His wife probably did not know about his past. In January of 1967, the German Stasi, the Secret Service, East German Secret Service, gets a tip that Bloch is living in a small town in East Germany, and they arrest him. Already on his second day in the investigation room, the Stasi presents him with a photograph of the little boy. And on the back of that photo, and I held this photo in my hands in Berlin, he wrote in his handwriting that, "I am the SS man with a rifle in his hands in a combat position and with a helmet on his head, aiming my rifle at the little boy," signed Josef Bloch Berlin. He was to go through interrogations for 2.5 additional years, and in July of 1969, he was executed, his body and belongings cremated, and buried in an unknown location in East Germany.
So who is the little boy, and what happened to him?
The exact identity of the little boy, I believe, will never be known. But in fact, I know of at least 7 or 8 claims to the identity of the little boy, ranging from Australia to Israel to Poland to France to England, and one in the United States. A physician living in New York was believed by many to be the little boy.
We should say Dr. Svi Nussbaum.
Yes, Dr. Svi Nussbaum. I must say he took that claim hesitantly. He never stated it in definitive terms. Unfortunately, I believe he is not the little boy, although this photograph very much represents his traumatic experience, his traumatic moment in the Holocaust.
You do find it, in a way, fitting that we can't really personalize this photo too much.
That's correct. This photo has become an icon. This is a photo that represents so many survivors whose childhood was robbed away from them by the German Nazis. And this boy stands for that childhood that went missing.
Dan Porat of Hebrew University in Jerusalem. His new book is The Boy, A Holocaust Story. Dan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The holiday season, shopping season, has opened. Yesterday, of course, was Black Friday, traditionally the busiest shopping day of the year, when retailers hope to climb out of the red financially. Sleigh bells are jingling, our cash tills ring-ting-tingling. Deal-determined shoppers flooded malls and big-box retailers across the country hoping to snatch up bargains, like these folks who were out really, really early.
Got up at 3:30 to get out and get started. So we got here probably about 5 o'clock in the morning. We always say we're not going to, but then we see the papers and say, okay, well, this is a good price, so let's go.
My husband and son got up early this morning to go snowboarding and woke me up. So I thought, I don't have anything to do at home. I'm just going to come down. And I just thought I'd look at all the crazy people out here fighting for things.
That was Shane Thompson of Gainesville, Florida, and Lori Bielenberg of Salem, Oregon. Black Friday sales figures are not in yet, but this year retailers said that they've seen longer lines than in years past, and people seem to be spending more money. Now, in a moment, we'll hear from a marketing executive at Sears. But first, we're joined from New York by Dana Telsey. She's an expert on the retail industry and CEO of the Telsey Advisory Group. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And what's your immediate sense of this year's Black Friday? A good day for retailers?
I think it was a good day for retailers. I think it was better than last year. I think the traffic was there and the deals were enticing to people.
And is there a clear relationship between a good first day and a successful retail season?
Certainly helps to have a better first day. Typically, you get a lull period from this upcoming Monday until around December 14th. 40% of holiday sales typically occur between December 15th through the 25th.
Ms. Telsey, is there a retailer that you think is really getting it right this year, the right strategy at the right time?
I think Macy's is getting it right with localization initiatives and also with their upper-end Bloomingdale's chain. I think Limited is getting it right, both with Victoria's Secret and Bath & Body Works.
And what are they doing?
What Macy's is doing is the localization initiative for each different region. What Limited is doing is very carefully planned out launches, very competitive prices, and appealing product.
And as you look at the retail landscape, are you saying perhaps permanent changes among retailers during a time of a continuously tough economy?
Yes, I think some of the changes include managing inventory levels much more carefully. I don't think they're overstocked like they would be in the past. I think they're managing their expenses very carefully. The holiday hiring is up from last year, but they're going to be very careful about who stays on after the holiday season.
So we'll see some good numbers from this holiday season, but unemployment might jump back up when we're done.
I think it stays where it is. I think a lot of these holiday workers are seasonal workers to begin with. I think you have to watch carefully going into 2011 that the pace of sales continues.
You anticipate a lot of returns?
There always is.
What trends are you following as the holiday shopping season continues?
As the season continues, we're looking at multi-channel, how important the internet is and how that is growing in comparison to how the stores are growing. We're watching traffic trends and certainly how deep the markdowns are.
And for the moment, what how does shopping over the web compare, or what kind of slice out of the retail pie does it take from standalone retailers?
It's still very small. It's still a little less than 6% of overall retail sales. I estimate it to be growing significantly over the next few years.
And what do you see for the season following this, when we get into 2011?
2011, I think price is going to become even more important. There are cost pressures looming from overseas, whether it's in raw materials, whether it's in freight costs. I think retail is going to have to manage expenses tightly in order to be able to maintain the same rates of earnings growth. I think 2011, if we could see some sales growth come back, that will be a very positive indicator.
Retail industry expert Dana Telsey, who's CEO of the Telsey Advisory Group. She joined us this morning from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
They call you Lady Luck, but there is room for doubt. At times you have a very unladylike way of running out.
That's Skye Masterson, the fictional hero of the 1950s musical Guys and Dolls, a tale of inveterate gamblers and the women unlucky enough to love them. But there was a real-life figure behind the fedoras and razor-sharp suits.
Tall and thin with a bland mask of a face, he had close-set eyes that looked a little dead, at least until he offered you a bet. Then those dark eyes sparked and he smiled like he had good news. "Are you a gambling man?" he'd ask. "Because I am." Alvin was his name, but nobody called him that. They called him Titanic.
That's author Kevin Cook reading from his new biography, Titanic Thompson, The Man Who Bet on Everything.
He bet on pool, he bet on horseshoes, he bet on golf.
They called him Titanic because he could sink anybody. Titanic Thompson grew up dirt poor in Arkansas and took to the road as a teenager, moving from city to city looking for new suckers.
He bet on the horses. He bet on any game that you would offer him.
Luck be a lady tonight.
Titanic Thompson was part athlete, part huckster. In the book, Kevin Cook recounts a few of Titanic's best and most daring scams, like the time he wagered with Al Capone's gang in Chicago that he could drive a golf ball 500 yards.
Now, the clubs were made of hickory in those days. A 250-yard drive was sensational. He takes the money, writes down who has bet how much, and then says, okay, now that the bet's down, one thing is I'm not saying when I'm going to hit that 500-yard drive. He plays pool. They're all playing poker. This goes on for months. Finally, it's the middle of December when he stops and says, I feel it. I feel that drive coming on right now. A caravan of gentlemen goes out to a golf course alongside Lake Michigan, takes a practice swing, and then turns around, faces the lake, and knocks the ball out onto the lake, which is frozen at the edges, and the ball is still skittering toward Michigan as we speak, way more than 500 yards, and he took the money that day.
Right. And what was interesting about reading these anecdotes about the bets is that he really, his hustle was built on the cheat, but also mm-hmm. on athleticism. He practiced a tremendous amount.
Well, that's right, and I think his philosophy was if you can't beat him, cheat him. But generally, he would beat you with great physical skill, and nobody practiced his craft more than Titanic did. He would practice flipping cards, which you can do with great accuracy if you practice enough and you're dexterous enough.
And this is flipping cards, say, into a hat or something like that,
yes,
from a distance.
Yes, although one of Titanic's favorite tricks was to say, I can flip this playing card all the way across this restaurant and chop off the flower across the room over there. He wouldn't do it with one card because it couldn't be done, but he was accurate enough to use a sequence of cards, hit the exact same spot on the stem until, like a tree in the forest, that flower across the restaurant tumbles over and he collects his money.
You talk in the book about how the great sort of population shifts from rural areas to urban areas kind of fed this world of hustlers.
That's true. I mean, he goes back to the days of turkey shoots and before the Model T came out, when most people live between cities. There's no rapid communication. It helps him to be able to go into a city and to be able to take the money, get back out, and be unknown when he motors into the next city down the line. He was a road gambler. The people who were moving to big cities in those days were nostalgic for the old America. The frontier is now believed to be closed. It's the 20th century, and there was a pining for the individual out there who was not subject to authority of any kind. And in a lot of ways, Titanic really represented that essential American character.
One thing about the book that surprised me is you have a lot of detail and stories about the world that he occupied, but it seemed very difficult to get into the head of this character and of this person. Were you able to find out what motivated Titanic Thompson?
Well, I think I did find he was married 5 times, and fortunate in this case, he married women who were quite young, so even though he died in 1974, his 5th wife is still with us, wonderful person with great stories about Titanic, and I think her reading was the closest, that he was always looking for validation. He was a boy who came out of the Ozarks with nothing, entirely self-taught, lived by his wits and his guile. He was proud of that. You go through your entire life, you're testing yourself again and again, trying to assert your superiority against the people you're competing against. That's really what motivated him, and it was good to find that very much later in his life, he started to seek a little warm human companionship, mostly in his family.
Kevin Cook is the author of Titanic Thompson, The Man Who Bet on Everything. Kevin Cook, thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed it.